law school. What was the family doing in Canonsburg, and what was the financial situation and the...
Well, let me go back a few years. Dad, because as a teenager, had learned by his own diligence to read and write the English language, and had learned something about buying and selling because he was immediately got into peddling one thing or another, picture frames or whatever they could peddle for them. And so, at that time, of course, the coal companies were in very, very active development of the coal mining industry, with coal mines scattered all around Washington County, including Canonsburg. And as you probably know, one of the adjuncts of each coal mine was a company grocery store where the miners could buy their groceries and so on and so on. And they needed somebody of experience in merchandising and business and reading and writing. And so Dad became the manager not only of the Canonsburg store for one of the major coal companies, but for a group of stores. That group of mines and a group of stores, Four State Supply Company was the name of his stores, company stores.
F-O-U-R?
That's right, F-O-U-R. And I forget the name of the coal company, but it was owned by a family by the name of Jones in Canonsburg, who another relationship, Catholics, very lovely people, right near neighbors of ours. But they developed then the relationship between the coal baron and the grocery manager that was very warm and cordial. At any rate, that was Dad's background in his earlier years. And then he got into the real estate activity. And in my law school days, Dad was in the real estate business with his brother from Washington. So, and even though we continued to live all that time in Canonsburg, and Dad used to commute by a streetcar a half hour or so from Canonsburg to Washington. When I graduated law school, I decided to begin practice on my own in Washington County. And so I had a little room adjacent to my father's real estate office in Washington, and had an evening office in one of the spare bedrooms of our house in Canonsburg. And from that spare room, I graduated to a little office downtown Canonsburg after a year or two. And then, after 4 or 5 years of practicing in Washington County, in which time I was active in Democratic politics and solicitor for the county controller and had other work in Washington County, there arose a vacancy in the United States Attorney's Office in Pittsburgh. The appointment to the United States Attorney's Office is by the Attorney General and the President, and they had, and it was subject to investigation by the FBI. And word came to me that several recommendations had been made for the mayor of that vacancy, but the names recommended had not passed the FBI investigation. Would I be interested? And I indicated an interest that I would in 1938-39, I was named as an assistant to the United States Attorney's Office, the first Jew in the history of this district court. A Jew was named as an assistant to the United States Attorney's Office. And in that capacity, I had extensive responsibilities for matters relating to the Department of Justice and the government, working with the FBI, the Secret Service, and the Treasury Intelligence, and including the great rush of government acquisitions, first for the extensive flood control projects in western Pennsylvania, and then as the war came on in 39 and 40, 41, Navy had to acquire shipyard plant space, and the Army had to acquire the camp rentals on the River Mercer, and the other, Defense Plant Corporation had to build an emergency plant for making synthetic fuel. And so my job was to see that all these Army, Navy, and defense projects were acquired by the government and construction initiated. But in 1942, in the summer, I entered the military service from the United States Attorney's Office, not asking for any deferment or reason for deferment. Entered as a buck private, and
in the Army?
In the Army, he was assigned to the Air Force and sent to Fort Meade, where the inductees were sent, and from there was assigned to the Air Force. This was in September, October of 1942. And so when I was asked whether I want to go to the Air Force unit in Atlantic City or Miami Beach, with November coming up, I selected Miami Beach. The Army Air Force had extensive training facilities in Miami Beach at that time, having taken over almost all of the hotels. And there they did the basic training of the Air Force. They had an Air Force Air Officers Training School where they trained men who were made officers directly from civilian life. And then they had an officers candidate school to which they admitted men who were privates and who qualified to attempt to become officers. So after my stretch of 3 or 4 months as a buck private doing KP and everything else at the Army, I was admitted to the Army Air Force Officer Candidate School in Florida in about September, October of 1942. And after about 3 months there, graduated the Officer Candidate School as a second lieutenant and was assigned to the Army Air Force Air Intelligence School in Harrisburg. In Harrisburg, the Air Force operated a 2 months rather intensive instruction program for the Air Force officers who were to do intelligence work of one sort or another. And so I was assigned to that school. An interesting sidelight of that is this, that one of the distinguished women of Harrisburg at that time, Mary Sachs, who ran the very lovely department store, a very charitable woman, and who had a very beautiful home about only 2 blocks from where the Air Intelligence School was situated. So for each class, she would accept a half a dozen of the students to live in her home. So when my good friend George Bloom heard that I was coming to Harrisburg, I guess he talked to Mary Sachs. George Bloom was at that time probably the assistant to governor of Pennsylvania. George Bloom was originally from Washington County, a distinguished Jewish lawyer, about 10 years older than myself, who was very close to and General Martin, then Governor Martin, and then Governor Duff. And, the top hierarchy of the Republican Party. And so in Harrisburg, it got you know Mrs. Sachs. At any rate, we lived at Mary Sachs for those 2 months. And in the house with me, I think at that time, was Burgess Meredith. Yes. And Bob Maservi, his stage name, I think. He was in with so many trombones.
Oh, I remember that.
76 trombones. At any rate, after graduating the Army Air Force Air Intelligence School, I was assigned as a combat intelligence officer to a heavy bomber group that was then being organized in Alamogordo, New Mexico. When we got those orders in Harrisburg, we didn't know where New Mexico was, let alone Alamogordo. But nevertheless, we found it. It was an isolated desert spot on the Southern Pacific Railroad. Which also was the center for atomic bombing training right after we left. Our job there was to organize a working group of 4 squadrons who would train together for 30 or 60 days, and then the 4 squadrons as a group with their planes and their pilots and their armament officers would go over to the combat theater in the 8th Air Force in Europe to take part in heavy bombing of targets on the continent. And so, in July or so of 1943, we all shipped out from Alamogordo, New Mexico by train to the East Coast and then by boat on the Queen Elizabeth to England. They used the Queen Elizabeth because first it could hold about 14,000 troops when it was equipped just for a troop carrier, and secondly, it was fast enough to be able to outrun most German submarines. So it was used as a troop carrier because except for 500 or 600 miles from the Atlantic coast and 400 or 500 miles from England, it was without any air cover or air protection. Wow. So you had to have the speed and equipment as you could to get there. Well, so from in England, from a heavy bomber base in East Anglia, just north of Cambridge, for 2 years, our bomb group participated in bombing missions, bombing targets in occupied Europe and in Germany, and wherever we found the Germans building plants or having railroad marshaling yards or having facilities that should be destroyed. And my job as a combat intelligence officer was to help select the target, and by means of photographs projected on screens and other data, brief the crew 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, the pilots and the co-pilots and the navigators and bombardiers, as to what their target was and what it would look like from their bombing altitude, and also brief them on the weather that they were going to confront and what type of opposition they would be confronting. And then my task would then be to meet the crews when they returned from their bombing mission about 8 or 9 hours later, to interrogate the crews as to what they had seen, what they had done, get their photographs of their bombing, the done, see what accuracy they had performed, and otherwise to find out from them what they had seen and been accomplished on that mission. As the war went on, we also were confronted with the V-1 and V-2 bombs that the Germans were perfecting. The V-1 was both of them were pilotless. The V-1 would make some noise, so when you would hear it coming over your base, you could run into an air raid shelter. But the V-2 was a rocket that was launched from launching sites on the east coast, on the west coast of Europe, and as to which there was no warning. There was considerable damage all around our base, and there was considerable damage in major cities, particularly London. We used to visit London frequently, and at one time, I was sent to a British intelligence school just outside of London to learn methods of escape from prisoner of war camps should any of our pilots or crew members who have to bail out of in occupied Europe and be taken prisoner. The British, through vast experience in World War I and other parts of the world in World War II, had developed techniques which were rather secret, as to which I was not even permitted to inform my own commanding officer. But we would instruct certain members of the crew on each mission as to devices and methods that they could use, should they be taken prisoner of war, to be able to escape from the prisoner of war camps. And we also had to brief the crews that should they be shot down and have to bail out over occupied Europe, because at that time Belgium, Holland, France were all occupied by the Germans, my job was to instruct them as to how to hide out and get in touch with the French or Belgian or Dutch underground, so that hopefully we could get them down to Spain, across the Pyrenees into neutral Spain, and then get them back into the United States, back into England. And it was a remarkable a mission. Might come back with three or four planes missing. We would learn that they had bailed out at certain places, and within two or three days, we would know exactly with whom in the underground they were in contact, when they were going to cross the Pyrenees, when they reached Spain, we'd get them flown back to England. If the target was in this area of Switzerland, then of course, if they ran into trouble, they were briefed to bail out or land in Switzerland, which was in a neutral country, and they would be interned for the duration.
You spent your... until the Germany surrendered,
yes.
You spent your war years in that phase.
We were there until the crossing of the Rhine and the eventual, the big raid, of course, was D-Day. But the crossing of the Rhine and the German surrender in the summer of spring of 75, we were then
45.
We were then sent back to the United States to an air base in Charleston, North Carolina or South Carolina, to have our 30-day leave and then be prepared to go to the Japanese theater with the new airplanes. Hmm. So it was during that 30-day period that I got married, with the hope that maybe I could stay here. And fortunately, it was during that 30-day period that there was Nagasaki and Hiroshima and the Japanese surrender.
You mentioned getting married, but you haven't brought us up to date on how you met your wife or
any
details.
Yeah. My wife is Lois Kaplan, the older daughter of Frank R.S. Kaplan of Pittsburgh. Frank was a prominent lawyer in McKeesport, and he had married Madeline Roth, whose father had invented the copperworld process for making coating steel with copper and using it for insulating wire. Well, and Frank, as a young lawyer, was one of the incorporators of Copperworld Steel Company. After serving on the school board and so on in McKeesport, the family moved to Pittsburgh. And Frank was always active in synagogue, in temple, B'nai B'rith, and all Jewish affairs. One day in 42 or so, one of the B'nai B'rith people in Pittsburgh, Kantrowitz, asked me to go with him to give blood. And at that place, on an adjoining table giving blood, was Frank Kaplan. So he suggested we go to his house and have a drink or something after that ordeal. And it was there that I met his daughter. And we continued, we saw each other before I went to the Army and overseas. We carried on a very active correspondence.
Was this prior to the First World War, service in World War II, or was this between the surrender of Germany and...
No, this is before I went overseas.
I see.
This is before I went overseas.
1942.
I had met Lois and recorded and then went overseas. We corresponded. Uh-huh. And then as soon as I got back, and during this 30-day leave, we got married. It was also amusing that during this 30-day period, and just a few days before we got married, I had to be in Washington, D.C. to meet with some people to Department of Justice, and I met there one of my old friends from the department who asked me what I was doing, and I told him I'd just returned from overseas. He says, how would you like to go back to Germany with us? And I says, what's going on? He says, we are forming a cadre of four lawyers to go over and try the Nuremberg trials. And I said, well, that would not be wonderful. I said, can I take my wife? He said, no, you can't do that because conditions are such that there are no facilities. I said, what am I supposed to do, get married and say to my wife, it's nice knowing you, I'll see you in 6 months. And so I had to turn it down. It was amusing that when I told that story to my father-in-law, he told me I was foolish, I should have accepted it. At any rate.
What was the date you got married, Elliot? Do you remember? What year?
July 19. Did I write it down?
1945,
yes. July 12, 1945. I remember it very distinctly because I just looked it up.
And Jack Rothschild married you.
Yes. And he was in his Marine uniform.
And where were you married?
At Westmoreland Country Club. And I was then a captain. I had been promoted from time to time. And I was then a captain in the Air Force. One of the assignments over in Europe was a tour of duty with the British Navy on a British destroyer in the North Sea to get acquainted with their operations, and a tour of duty on the continent to see the type of anti-aircraft equipment that our own forces were using and the type that they had captured from the Germans, because it was important that we be able to advise our bombing crews what sort of ground anti-aircraft fire they might be confronting in their bombing missions.
And when were you discharged from the service?
It was in, must have been August of 1945. Yes, because the Japanese had surrendered and everybody was being discharged. I could have been discharged probably on the basis of length of service, but fortunately it was a discharge, not a discharge, based upon the termination of hostilities. Although, as we went through our discharge routine at one or another of the bases, they would ask us if we want to stay in the service, but very few of us wanted any more of that. We had enough of it.
So that being married now and being away from law for approximately 3 or 4 years, you were ready to pick up a new life,
yes.
Presumably here in Pittsburgh.
Yes. I returned to the United States Attorney's Office, the Department of Justice, and continued there until 1950, during which time, of course, our first child, Susan, was born, I think 1946. And we lived in one house or one apartment or another in Pittsburgh until 1950, when we moved into our present home on Darlington Road. Yes.
Susan, your only child?
And our second child, Nancy, was born in 1950, when we were living at, we were living in an apartment, but she was only 6 months old or so when we moved into our home in Darlington Road. She was born April 22, 1950. Susan was born June 15, 1946. Susan is married to Benjamin B. Wexler, W-E-C-H-S-L-E-R, a young attorney whose father was Maurice Wexler, and whose grandfather was the very well-known Dr. B.B. Wexler, the obstetrician.
Do they have
they
children?
They have one daughter, Julie, who will be 3 years of age on March 4 this year. And they live in Pittsburgh at Barton Street. B.B. is in the general practice of law, and he's also a deputy attorney general of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, working with the Pennsylvania Department of Transportation. Susan had graduated Winchester Thurston School, where she had attended all her life, then went to Wheaton College, and upon graduation from there, she taught at Winchester for several years until after her marriage, and it became apparent that they were going to have this child.
Nancy
likewise had attended Winchester throughout her academic years, and upon graduation went to Simmons College, graduated there. She was then courting a young man who was at MIT, and they married, they got married on their graduation from college, which would have been about 1972, and he wanted to pursue not academics at that time, but industrial work. So he became associated for 1 year with McDonnell Douglas in Long Beach, California. And he worked on the Skylab project that was launching that spacecraft into outer space as a rotating laboratory.